Green Yard. Chief Justice Steele, the members of the court, may it please the court, might note that for me this is tremendous opportunity and a highlight of my career. As the court's well aware, we're here today for the appeal of State v. Jamel Daniels, and I'm presenting argument on behalf of the appellant. I won't bore the court with a recitation of the matters raised in the brief. I'd just like to highlight, if I could, some of the more salient reasons why we believe that the court should reverse the conviction that was entered by Superior Court in DeCastle County. There's many quotations in our brief about the effect of improper argument during a criminal trial, but perhaps the most overriding factor, given the importance of refraining from improper argument, is that in a criminal trial, almost always, the state has unlimited resources. There are few criminal trials that occur in this country where there's a major case being litigated and the defendant can match the resources of the state. This was true in the incident matter. The defendant did not utilize a DNA expert. Instead, the defense of the DNA evidence that came in was limited to cross-examination by defense counsel. There's no doubt that this was an integral part of the case. Both the prosecution and the defense recognized that. In fact, their first 41 pages of the transcript in the appendix before you, attached to appellant's brief, A14 through A24, represents the direct examination of the DNA expert, Terry Lawton. And in that impressive testimony, there is a colloquy between the prosecutor and the expert that climaxes in a discussion of the overwhelming percentage that the DNA testing revealed tying the defendant Jamel Daniels to the DNA found on a cigarette butt located at the crime scene by detectives. This was also very technical testimony, and that underscores that in summation, when the prosecutor made a reference, actually twice, that the cigarette butt meant that Jamel Daniels was not merely at the scene, but at the scene, indicating clearly that he was a participant in the murder.
That was countered directly in argument by defense counsel, wasn't it?
That he was at the scene, sir?
That he was, the cigarette butt did not show that he was at the scene.
That's correct. The argument, that argument was raised. But I believe that even though the counter-argument was made by defense counsel, given the highly technical nature of the DNA testimony and the percentages including therein, that I don't believe it could have effectively have dealt with the linkage, the leap that the prosecutor made between what the DNA evidence established and any evidence establishing that he was a participant in the murder.
Would it be any different if it was, say, a fingerprint on the cigarette?
Well, a fingerprint on the cigarette butt certainly I don't think would be any different, because fingerprint on a weapon would certainly be a stronger nexus between the murder than anything on a cigarette butt. I think it's important to note that this there was no weapon found. There were no reliable eyewitnesses. Under the standard enunciated in State v. Hughes, it was a close case.
And what was Mr. Daniels' defense?
Your Honor, from what I can understand, that the defense appeared to be that the state didn't meet its burden of proof, that it didn't rise to beyond a reasonable doubt.
So Mr. Daniels did not testify?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And no weapon was found?
No weapon was found.
And we have the two people that made an arrangement with the state that testified that he was one of the shooters.
That's correct. And these two individuals were basically cronies of the other major defendants.
Was that argued to the jury?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that the inference that the prosecutor asked the jury to draw was unreasonable, or that there was simply a failure to make clear that there might be multiple inferences that could be drawn from the same fact, that is, where the cigarette butt was found?
My argument, sir, is that there was no inference argued, that it was a clear mischaracterization of what the evidence was, and that, you know, there's a void, there's a gap in the evidence, which could have legitimately been argued by the state, to say that one could infer, et cetera, et cetera, and that was done. Instead, the prosecutor analyzed this evidence to fill that gap in summation.
So your argument is that where the prosecutor uses the phrase, it tells you that the defendant was at the scene, that it tells you is not the proper choice of words to introduce such an inference?
That, along with the fact that the discussion of the cigarette butt is done in connection with the DNA evidence and linked also to the testimony of the officers, that the way that it was couched, the language that was used twice, that it means that he wasn't at the scene, but at the scene, that he wasn't merely watching. That the cigarette butt being near the body tells you that he was a murderer. That's what I'm arguing here.
Would it have been okay for the prosecutor to say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you may infer from this DNA evidence that the defendant is at the scene?
A little bit even beyond that, sir, to say that the evidence clearly establishes that the defendant was in the vehicle. There was other testimony that established that at some point he got out of the vehicle, that shots were heard, that, you know, there was physical evidence supporting the fact that he was at the scene. But, you know, to take the fact, to argue before the jury that the physical evidence showed that he was a participant in the murder was improper.
But if the prosecutor had used the words, you may infer, would it then pass muster?
I believe so, because at that point, Your Honor, the jury clearly delineate the line between argument and a summation or characterization of the evidence.
Mr. Fountain, I get the impression from your opening brief that what you were doing was singling out one piece of evidence from a multitude of evidence, specifically the DNA on the cigarette butt, and then arguing that the prosecutor pointed to that one piece of evidence and said to the jury, you may, that piece of evidence shows that the defendant was at the scene. My question is, isn't that a little bit nearsighted? That is, there was a multitude of evidence, and the prosecutor, in making the argument that your client is complaining about, referenced all of that, including the DNA.
Well, Your Honor, I do wear glasses, and so I plead guilty to be nearsighted, but the fact is that
Maybe I should have said narrowly focused.
The fact is that I think that that part of the evidence was the only one that the improper remarks were linked to.
Is that right? The summation was, in addition to the evidence, in addition to the testimony that was presented, the state also presented evidence, physical evidence, and that evidence is very important because it does two things. And then the prosecutor goes on and says that it corroborates the testimony, and so forth.
That's correct. And she goes on and gets to the point where... let me have a moment.
I think you're looking for page A33 or A34 of your appendix.
Okay. Yes. And then she goes on to say that after talking about the Glock, you'll be able to take back with you Terry Lawton, who was the DNA analyst that testified about the probabilities that that cigarette butt, the DNA on that cigarette butt, matched the defendant. And what she testified to, that one out of every 718,207,8,909 African Americans would be excluded, one out of that many, pretty conclusive that the DNA evidence of this, which was found inches away from the .45 caliber casings and inches away from Kenny's body, were his. And again, you have that linkage really where the DNA evidence conclusively indicate that the defendant was a participant in the murder. And I think that was a problem.
I thought the argument in your brief was that the testimony of the other two defendants was not credible, and that if you stated unequivocally that the DNA evidence proved your client was out of the car when the person was shot, that that would resolve any doubt the jury had about those two men's credibility, and that's why it was prejudicial to your client. Is that your argument?
No, I don't believe so, sir. I think that recognizing that credibility of the other defendants is certainly something that the jury would factor in to their verdict, but I think that's really outside the realm of the prosecutor's ability to influence that on summation.
Mr. Fountain, I think Justice Holland's point is, if I understood your brief, that in a case that's otherwise close, and when you're relying primarily on the testimony of admittedly involved criminals as the foundation for putting your person there as one who intends to commit a murder along with them, and that the critical issue is whether he was inside or outside the car, as you talk about, was he at the scene or truly at the scene? The issue was the DNA, an independent, objective, scientific test, which always seems to impress juries, no matter how much hocus-pocus accompanies it, was intended to show that these two co-defendants must be credible because, after all, there's objective scientific evidence that supports their view that he was outside the car and therefore at the scene. Didn't Justice Holland and I both get that point from your brief correctly?
I would just go one step further and say that outside the car does not mean that he pulled the trigger.
No, I understand that, but as I understand what you cited to us at A34 in your appendix, what you consider to be the critical words used by the prosecutor to mischaracterize the DNA evidence, the mischaracterization was prejudicial to the extent it linked the DNA inappropriately to the important critical fact that Mr. Daniels was outside of the car at the scene, which is, to ordinary people, significant because it suggests a willing, active participant as opposed to somebody who was remaining in the car and may or may not have known what actually was going to happen outside the car, correct?
Certainly.
Can you help us out? You cite Hughes and you say that this is a mischaracterization similar to what troubled this court in Hughes. Can you tighten that analogy for me a little bit?
Sure.
How is the mischaracterization you point out on A34, page 13 of your opening brief, how is that similar to what was reversible error in Hughes?
Well, here, during the cross-examination of the DNA expert, I think Mr. Del Coyer brought out the fact that, you know, other than saying that there was DNA that matched the defendant with a cigarette, but she couldn't say anything beyond that. How it got there, even whether it was the result of smoking or not. There was some discussion about whether he could have shed skin cells on it. And that was pretty clear. Now, the other prongs of the Hughes test was, you know, what curative action was taken by the trial court. And if you look at the sidebar conference that accompanied this, initially the trial judge was confused about what the nature of the objection was. When it became clear what the objection was, he felt that that was, you know, a fair argument, and that there was no curative action taken by the court. So I think that it's closest to Hughes in that respect than the other accompanying cases, Boats in the case, I believe the Hooks case, are also cited for the three-prong test.
You mentioned in your initial comments concern that the defense didn't have a DNA expert. First, do you know why the defense didn't seek to call a DNA expert? And secondly, if they had, is there any suggestion from what you know about the case that there would have been been testimony that contradicted the state's DNA expert if they had called one?
My understanding about the DNA's role in the defense strategy was that their own testing indicated that it indeed was the defendant's DNA, that it was conclusive. But the usually DNA evidence of this type is defended by attacking the collection, the storage, and they had no expert with that type of experience. I think it's important to point out also that the state's expert had apparently only testified 5 times in court prior to this. So this was sort of a very new area, I suppose, for it to be defended in that way.
You wanted to reserve 5 minutes for your rebuttal. You still have 7 minutes.
I might have a moment.
Yes.
I have no additional remarks. Thank you.
All right.
And please the court. Just to clear up one point, Daniels did testify. Actually, initially he made a statement to the police that he had stayed in the hotel room with both Martinez and the other Mosley, and that Lou Price had left and then came back sometime later, therefore indicating that Price was the shooter.
So in Daniel's defense, it was an alibi defense?
Initially in his statements to the police. Then at trial, he testified, okay, I was in the car. All right, I was in the passenger seat like everybody said. Then we stopped on Douglas Road, which turned out to be Adams Dam Road. Price gets out of the car. Martinez gets out of the car. Martinez motions to Griffith to get out of the car. Then the two shoot Griffith to death. I had nothing to do with it. That was his defensive trial. But I was there. I was there.
Would you say the prosecutor's statement in this case was accurate based on the testimony of the DNA expert?
Yeah, well, it's not. That's the main point I want to make. I think both in trial and on appeal, the defense is really mischaracterizing her argument. I mean, the DNA evidence is one part of the evidence that indicates that Daniels was outside the car. It was the fact that the cigarette butt was found basically mingled in with the .45 caliber Glock cartridges, which were found a few feet away from the body, which corroborated, and that's the way the prosecutor starts her argument, the portion of her argument. There is physical evidence that corroborates the testimony of Martinez and Mosley.
I thought the DNA expert said the most you can say is that a cigarette butt with Daniel's DNA on it was outside the car.
Yes.
But she could not say that Daniel's was outside the car.
By no means.
Now, I read the prosecutor's closing statement as saying the presence of the cigarette butt outside the car means that Daniel's was outside the car.
Only because Daniel's DNA is found on him. If Daniel's DNA had not been found on it, or, well, actually both Daniel's and Price's DNA was found on it, if the defendant's DNA had not been found on it, it simply would have been a cigarette butt found near the scene of the crime.
But if someone took a cigarette butt that you used outside of this building to a place that you had never been, the fact that the cigarette butt with your DNA on it was found somewhere down State Street doesn't mean you were down State Street, does it?
No, by no means, but it's certainly a reasonable inference. In other words, it's some evidence. It's not conclusive. I don't think the prosecutor ever argued that it was conclusive.
I think the difficulty here for me is if you address it as a mischaracterization and find the mischaracterization independent of all the other evidence to be troublesome, the difficulty is you call an expert who says, in response to your question, no, I can't say that the fact that the DNA evidence is on the cigarette butt actually means that Daniels was ever outside the car. I can't say that. Then the prosecutor, with the last word, no way of being contradicted by anyone, says, quote, so that tells you, the jury, that the defendant was not in the car but was actually physically standing there at the scene outside of the car. Now, on what basis does the prosecutor say that the DNA evidence tells the jury that when the prosecutor's own expert says you can't go that far with it? That's what I think the focus of the mischaracterization is on. The power that the prosecutor has of the last word and the danger of overstating the case.
And then the prosecutor immediately says, and may be disorganized, the argument may be disorganized, but as you recall from Detective DiNardo, who testified that the cigarette butt, which was fresh, actually still had an ash attached to it when he collected it, was only feet away from Kenny's body and inches away from the .45 caliber casings, which were fired from the Glock. So that tells you the defendant was not in the car, but was actually physically standing there at the scene outside the car. So the DNA evidence standing alone does not establish that. What establishes that is that DNA evidence establishes that at some point the defendant was smoking that cigarette. And from the position of the cigarette butt, we could say that the defendant, there's at least a reasonable inference that the defendant was outside the car.
Well, when did your quote of the prosecutor stop and your argument begin?
I'm sorry?
When does your quote, you said, and the prosecutor went on, and then you went on, you never told me when you're quoting the prosecutor.
Immediately after the portion that you read, Your Honor. First of all, because it starts out, that paragraph starts out, First of all, it's important, the DNA evidence is important, because it tells you that the defendant was at the scene on April 10, 2001, and at the scene, not in the car really watching what happened, but at the scene, as you recall from Detective DiNardo, he testified.
Well, how can you say the DNA evidence tells you the defendant was outside the car when the DNA expert said, I can't tell you that?
I think the argument here is probably not organized well, but the prosecutor then immediately goes on to say, now here is the evidence that establishes, in addition to the DNA evidence, which establishes that he was a smoker of the cigarette, we have his position mingled in almost with the .45 caliber casings and near the victim's body. That is, I think one has to read that argument as one.
Let's imagine you're the jury sitting there. What you appear to be saying is, it certainly sounded like the prosecutor said the DNA evidence is important because the DNA evidence tells you Daniels wasn't just in the car, Daniels was outside the car.
Right.
But now if the jury listened to everything else, even though the prosecutor might have given that impression, everything else would have put that impression into perspective, and you'd really know that the prosecutor wasn't saying the DNA evidence established Daniels was outside the car. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That it's the entire, the argument has to be taken as a whole. So I don't think it's a mischaracterization of the evidence. Like I say, the DNA evidence is important because it shows that Daniels was a smoker of the cigarette.
Whether or not what the prosecutor said was a mischaracterization, I take it would have been a proper argument or a proper characterization if the prosecutor had said, we know that a critical issue is whether or not the defendant was outside the car
right
at the time of the shooting. The DNA on the cigarette butt, which was found in the midst of these .45 caliber shells, we believe shows that. Now, I understand that the other side will argue something else.
Which they did.
Perhaps that the defendant was smoking the cigarette in the car, and then one of the shooters took it and put it in his mouth and then dropped the cigarette. And that's for you to decide. If that had been the argument, that would not have been a mischaracterization of anything. Is that right?
Certainly. I mean, the argument could have been made.
Okay. If that had been the argument, and everything else had, and the evidence had been the same, would you have had reasonable doubt? That is, would you have had enough to go to the jury? When all you had in the way of establishing that the defendant was outside the car was an inference, but one that could have been rebutted by a counter-inference had one been argued.
Yes, well, I think the counter-inference is for the defense to argue.
Correct.
And the defense did argue.
But the defense is, I think the defense is saying here, we don't have to argue it because your inference without more doesn't get you to a jury. It's not probable cause. I'm sorry, it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
And I think it's important that the prosecutor begins her argument by saying, it's important because it corroborates the testimony of the witnesses. That's what we're relying on, the testimony of Martinez and Mosley to establish this. And this is corroborative evidence. Just standing alone doesn't establish
it. That's why it's so important, isn't it, for the prosecutor to try to convince this jury that the DNA evidence is not only definitive, but it resolves alone any issue of whether Daniels was in or outside the car, because according to the prosecutor, after mentioning Detective DiNardo and the fact that the butt was near the .45 shell casings, the final comment of the prosecutor is, so that tells you that the defendant was not in the car, but was actually physically standing there at the scene outside of the car.
Yes, it's corroborative evidence of the testimony of Martinez and Mosley.
But why was it characterized as definitive? It wasn't characterized as merely additional evidence from which you may draw a reasonable inference in anticipation of it being rebutted by the defense. the way that the prosecutor characterizes that DNA evidence, because it's so critical to corroborate the two criminals who testified against Daniels, is that it's definitive. It answers any question you may have had about whether Daniels was in or outside the car. Isn't that what that phrase says? And is that truly what the expert testified to?
No, the expert didn't testify to that. The expert testimony standing alone certainly does not establish that. It's only when it's put together with the other evidence.
I understand that, but that's the whole point here. The prosecutor's argument suggests that standing alone, it does definitively resolve it.
I disagree, Your Honor. I disagree. I think she starts out her argument by saying this is corroborative evidence.
Well, doesn't she say expressly, it tells you that the defendant was at the scene and that it is the DNA that she's referring to?
And again, I can only say, you know, perhaps the argument is structured infelicitously and should have begun. There is also evidence that corroborates the testimony of Mosley and Martinez.
Well, Mr. Donovan, help me understand the corroboration aspect. If you and another person are sitting at a table and you both smoke the same cigarette, and then the cigarette is outside the building, how does that tell you that both people were definitely outside the building?
Standing alone, it doesn't. That's why I'm insisting this is corroborative evidence, and I think that's correctly characterized by the defendant, by the prosecutor. That Daniels was one of the shooters is established by the testimony of Mosley and Martinez. This is simply evidence that corroborates that testimony. It does not establish anything, the fact that the cigarette butt was found there.
I don't see how the cigarette butt gets Daniels out of the car at all. Just tell me that. How does that happen?
Well, if he's outside smoking the cigarette, found near the 45 caliber casings, I mean, it's reasonably inferable that when he shoots the defendant, or the victim, he's smoking a cigarette butt, and then smoking a cigarette, then throws it down and gets back in the car. I mean, that's the inference.
Is there evidence from sharing of the cigarette or inference of sharing of the cigarette outside the car? Or
no. No, it's just that the DNA of both Price and Daniels were found on the cigarette. As far as I know, there is no testimony. Well, there's testimony that everybody was smoking on the way down, and apparently Price and Daniels were sharing a cigarette on their way. And, I mean, our argument was that when they got outside the car, Daniels was the one who had the cigarette, because Mosley and Martinez said that Daniels was the one who had the 45 caliber Glock.
Yeah, and your argument, as I understand it, is despite the fact that the DNA evidence definitively showed that both Price and Daniels had smoked the cigarette, and that both Price and Daniels also were outside the car. That's what your prosecutor said. It establishes not only that they both smoked the cigarette, but that they were both outside the car.
No, the cigarette butt only goes to Daniels because it's found in the vicinity of the 45 caliber casings. And Mosley and Martinez said that Daniels was the one who had the 45 caliber Glock. And so it has nothing to do with Price.
Where did they say Price was at the time of the shoot?
Price was on the other side.
Other side of what?
Of the victim.
So they were both
Price fired from the front.
So they were both outside the car, according to the informant's testimony.
Yeah. And Price shot from the front, and Daniel shot from behind. And like I said, the cigarette butt is found among the 45 caliber casings that, according to the eyewitnesses, Daniels used. And well, so it's some evidence from which the jury can infer that Daniels was, in fact, one of the shooters, was outside the car, shot the 45 caliber weapon, and because his the cigarette butt is found among the .45 caliber cases.
Mr. Donovan,
I happen to think that's a legitimate argument.
Just to button down one point, is it your side's position that the prosecutor's summation did not mischaracterize the evidence at all?
Yes.
It's not in the alternative that even if there was a slight exaggeration of the significance of that evidence, whatever error was created was harmless?
Yes. And while I'm saying that, I mean, the argument could have been made more felicitously. Is it not reasonably inferable, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, from this evidence that, and so on and so forth. Prosecutors do tend to make their point strongly, perhaps a little bit too strongly at times, but it's just the nature of the beast. Yes, I wish, certainly, and I think we all wish that we phrase things differently, but I think this is simply a matter of phraseology. The argument could have been constructed better. They arrive at the butcher conclusion in the middle of your evidence that supports the conclusion. Put your topic sentence first, as we all learn in school, and then put your supporting facts underneath. No, as far as a mischaracterization of the evidence, no. And I think it's reasonably inferable, as I say. From the evidence, the DNA evidence and the other evidence, that this is corroborative evidence of the testimony of the two eyewitnesses. And that's my only point. And I think Judge Tolliver, picked up on that and simply overruled the objection, saying it was, proper argument. And it's an opening summation, not a rebuttal summation. And you're free to rebut it in your summation, which was done. So I see no real prejudice to the defense, and I think in the main, even though it could have been said more felicitously, structured better, it was nevertheless a proper argument. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Remarks to make in light of the presentation of the state. First of all, the argument of the trial prosecutor was not disorganized. It clearly was not disorganized. She doesn't ramble. She doesn't go back and forth between the evidence. This is a very experienced major felony prosecutor.
You're saying her comment was felicitous, not infelicitous.
Basically, moreover, I think it's salient to point out that when there's discussion about the odds of the DNA evidence being anything other but belonging to Jamel Daniels, she again recites these overwhelming numerical percentages. 1 out of 719 million African Americans. And this is important because, again, the DNA evidence is highly technical, almost mathematical evidence that's very impressive to juries, because had Terry Lawton been a lay witness and said something that was well within the common knowledge and understanding of lay jurors, and the prosecutor had mischaracterized that, most of the jurors probably would have said, well, I remember that, and she didn't quite say that. But here, when you're dealing with DNA evidence, which is relying on these overwhelming percentages, the temptation and the danger is that its probative value becomes prejudicial because there's linkage between what it established and the probability of guilt, and that's what occurred here.
Are you saying a DNA evidence should be discussed differently than, say, fingerprint evidence?
I believe, Yes, I do, because I believe that DNA evidence is much more persuasive by the numbers, the uniqueness than fingerprint evidence.
Well, there have never been found matching fingerprints other than identical twins, right?
But, you know, the fingerprint evidence, though, you know, lacks date and time indicators that I think that, you know, you can certainly isolate more with DNA evidence. Remember, part of the testimony here presented by the state was that there was still ash on this cigarette butt, meaning that, you know, it was something that was fairly contemporaneous. And this was highlighted both in the DiNardo's testimony, when he explained why it was collected, and it's linked here in summation by the prosecution, again, with the DNA evidence. And that's really the danger here, is because when that gap between what the expert has said and the ultimate issue of the defendant's guilt or innocence, and there's an improper argument made by the state, on this highly technical evidence, the jury can easily be misled, however unintentionally, in believing, well, you know, it's overwhelming evidence that he committed the crime.
Mr. Fountain, Mr. Donovan says that your excerpt from the prosecutor's summation that appears at A34 of your appendix is not the closing argument by the prosecutor, but the opening argument. I'm embarrassed that I don't know with certainty that that's correct. Was there anything in the prosecutor's closing argument, assuming that's true, that repeated what you've characterized as a mischaracterization of the DNA evidence?
Your Honor, I did not bring the transcript, but I don't believe so. And I don't believe that the defense, even if it's rebuttal argument, can really cure or correct or defend against this linkage of the evidence, because it is the state's evidence. And the state took considerable time to put this evidence on. And again, as I indicated in my opening, it was very impressive, because it climaxes with a discussion between Mr. Apostolico and the witness about these percentages. And it ends there. And, you know, the defense can say, well, what it wants to, but it's limited really to what little it got out of cross-examination.
Are you saying, as part of your argument, that the prosecutor intentionally misstated the evidence and intentionally misled the jury, or just happened to make a mistake?
I don't think she intentionally misled the jury, but I think it's noteworthy that twice she says that, you know, the evidence shows that he wasn't merely in the car as an observer. He was there at the scene. And at the scene, there were only, there was one victim and two assailants. And it clearly indicated that he was the murderer.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Fountain.
Thank you.
Take the case under advisement.
Please rise.